So, I want to speak today about what counts as a healthy voice. I've been thinking about Nina Eidsheim's comment yesterday that every voice is a collective voice, co-constructed with and by those who listen. And I feel like when we listen to the pop singers we love, of whom Lauryn Hill is one for me, we expect they'll subscribe to an unspoken investment in an innocuous sounding construct called vocal health, which we imagine will allow them to sing exactly the same way they did when we first left them. And I want to trouble this notion that vocal health is a neutral, ideology-free term. The idea of the healthy voice could also be heard to drive that other, you know, often presented as an unassailable truth, that a singer will find her voice, and having done so, always sound healthily the same. I think this puts a singer in the position of always having to keep that voice that she has found. So again, health is ideological. The blues-infused, soaring, cracking vocals of a black woman, so basic to the creation of the rock sound, and I'm thinking Mary Clayton shouting rape, murder, in the Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter in 1969, will not cut it in terms of the classical voice teacher's definition of vocal health. But part of what the black voice is expected to perform and what is so greatly celebrated is the performance of suffering. It is the crack in the voice as evidence of great emotion and great hardship, the romanticized, aestheticized ideal of unhealth that has historically made audiences cheer and buy millions of records. From the spirituals to the blues and beyond, the black singer is called upon to render the trauma of black suffering not only audible, but grandly beautiful. Her failure to do so is often cause for censure. In 2014, in an article titled, "It's Finally Time to Stop Caring About Lauryn Hill," Stefan Schumacher wrote, quote, "What is she so mad about, and why hasn't she been able to channel it into a coherent musical statement? That kind of emotion should inspire something big and important. It would be great to hear," end quote. Now, let's be clear. Ms. Lauryn Hill, as she prefers to be called now, is unafraid to go on stage and display a voice that cracks. But for some reason, this kind of voice is heard as a failure to meet the standards of beautiful or commercially viable suffering. And why is that? Here I want to think the idea of health in tandem with the idea of risk. What lessons, I ask, does Ms. Lauryn Hill have for us about how to sing and how to risk the voice? Lauryn Hill is an icon of the 90s, her sound emblematic of a moment in hip-hop that stretched expansively to draw in a wider audience than ever before. As a member of the trio The Fugees, her talent and presence helped fuel the considerable success of the 1996 album The Score, which sold over 17 million copies. Her solo album The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, released in 1998, sold 12 million copies and earned her 5 Grammys. Lauryn Hill was a rare combination. A super smart Ivy League student, a multi-talented artist, singer, rapper, songwriter, and producer, a glamorous performer with movie star glam. She starred opposite Whoopi Goldberg in Sister Act 2 when she was still a teenager, who was also conscious and politically engaged. So it's a rare combination, right? And then around the year 2000, she abruptly dropped off the world stage. She withdrew from performing commitments, declined offers, including the chance to star in Charlie's Angels, and closed her nonprofit refugee project. She withdrew from public life, had 5 children with Rohan Marley, became intensely religious under the tutelage of a mysterious figure known as Brother Anthony. An appearance on MTV Unplugged in 2002 was described by reviewers as a public breakdown. Then, after going to prison in 2013 due to the extensive back taxes she owed to the US government, she began performing more, presumably, fans speculated, to raise money to settle her debts. So, ever since the shine of the late 90s Lauryn Hill persona began to fade, critics have disparaged her voice as raspy, hoarse, cracking, and sometimes inaudible. Her performance and style are described as bizarre, enigmatic, eccentric. She is no longer the darling of the music and entertainment industries that she once was. And some dedicated fans remain loyal, waiting 2 hours or more to hear her perform. She's notoriously late in many cases these days. And in contrast to critics, fans celebrate her sound as raw, beautiful, emotional. There are other stories of vocal health that Lauryn Hill's voice does not align with. So consider Whitney Houston. There is more or less consensus that her voice sounded amazing toward the beginning of her life and a lot less so toward the end. Or Aretha Franklin, asked last year how her voice was doing. The 73-year-old Queen of Soul asserted, quote, "My voice has aged absolutely fabulously well, and it's better than ever," end quote. Not all of us can say this, right? Lauryn Hill's more recent recordings don't trace for me either a clear decline or a clear sustaining of her vocal powers. Another word that is applied by critics to her performances these days is uneven. The narrative of vocal health or unhealth is not a simple one to parse, so I argue we have to listen especially hard. My exercise is to take Ms. Lauryn Hill's voice seriously, to listen to the sound of it, and not just the sound of what people say about it. As an artist, as a vocalist, what is she risking? And what does that risk sound like? How might we hear this risk through the filter of vocal health? So I'm going to play clips of three tracks of sort of early Lauryn Hill. They're each about a minute, and I've cut them all together. Killing Me Softly, which you all know, right, from the Fugees' score in 1996. Then there's a track called The Sweetest Thing, which is actually kind of hilariously from the Love Jones soundtrack with Refugee Camp All-Stars featuring Lauryn, and then To Zion, which is from Miss Education in 97. So, but first let me say a little bit about what I hear in Ms. Hill's voice across these tracks. And I bring my vocal coach ears to this, right? So, in Killing Me Softly, there is the buzz, and I mean that in the best of senses. That buzz in the voice that is an acoustic illusion so useful to a singer. It lands on the ear with a cutting volume, a loudness that takes little effort to produce. So, right, so instead of A, that buzz. I feel like my phone is causing problems. We get that casual scrape in the voice, the vocal fry. And we also get the glottal attack. And eyes, the vocal folds, that glottal attack, that makes a sound seem courageous and is often the most practical attack for a powerful high note. And yet at times the vocal sound has a lightness, which I mean in terms of weight, as though if you held the voice in your hands, at times it would feel weightier and then lighter, more airborne. At times the sound releases into that lightness, and we can talk about what the vocal folds may or may not be doing to make a heavier or lighter sound. I listen for the smooth, easy ripple of vibrato, the warmth and heft of the voice, right? So let me, I'm interested in this lightness, heaviness thing, right? So if these are not just my hands holding the weight of the sound, but actually my folds, my vocal folds, how much mass of the vocal folds is coming together? Is it just a bit of it to get a lighter sound, or is there more mass? And the sound I'm suggesting feels heavier when we listen to it. So that heft, which has to do with how much work the vocal folds are doing, how much mass is engaged. And beyond lightness or heaviness, in The Sweetest Thing, I also hear a breathiness, notes ghosted out on the release, like the shadow of a note, but the shadow is made of breath. And in To Zion, I listen for what feels like the muscle and elasticity of the sustained tones, the finesse of vibrato, where riff shimmers into vibrato and back out again. So let's listen.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style, and so I came to see him and listen for a while, and there he was, this young boy, stranger to my eyes, strumming my pain with his fingers. Makes me argue just to see.
how much you're in love with me. See, like a queen, a queen.
Look at your career, they say, Lauren, baby, use your head. But instead, I chose to use my heart.
Now the joy of my world is in Zion.
So Lauren sounds a little different nowadays, which we'll get to. The well-publicized accounts of pop singers' voice problems reinforce perceptions that singing popular song means risking vocal health. It's not least on the grounds of preserving singers' vocal health, specifically classical singers' vocal health, that jazz and classical vocal studies remain segregated in U.S. conservatories, for the most part with a couple interesting exceptions. Vocal health travels along racial fault lines and invokes the racialization of musical genre. Those who police and preserve good voices are those who warn against ruin, ruin of the voice. So, for example, from some 19th century experts, there's Manuel Garcia, Spanish voice teacher and the inventor of the laryngoscope. There he is looking at his vocal folds on a small mirror on a small mirror on a tilted stick, right? I love it. So, and that was invented in the mid-19th century. Quote, freshness and steadiness are the most valuable properties of a voice, but are also the most delicate, most easily injured, and quickly lost. When once impaired, they are never to be restored, and this is precisely the condition of a voice which is said to be broken, which may be attributed to injudicious vocal education, the result being utterly to destroy the voice. Okay. And then we have, of course, Lamperti, teaching in the bel canto tradition, late 1900s, turn of the century. Quote, when the chest voice is forced up too high, right, so this is that heft I've been talking about. And when the chest voice is forced up too high, the head voice loses in mellowness and carrying power. How many beautiful alto voices have been ruined, caused to break by this unnatural method, end quote. Dire.